No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. Maria is not with us tonight because, unfortunately, she's at a memorial service for a woman who was Maria's mentor in life. So I'd like to mention on behalf of Maria that our deepest condolences go out to the family of Dr. Priscilla Partridge D. Garcia. Dr. Garcia was had a PhD in psychology from USC, and she was Helen of Troy for USC. Imagine that, one of the mascots for many years. We all know Helen, right? The face that launched a thousand ships. So even though I never met Dr. Garcia, I'm sure she was a lovely, lovely person. She was active in her community and received many, many honors. So our deepest condolences from our show go out to the Garcia family. And Maria, our thoughts and prayers are with you today. Today we have a very special guest. We have a young man who's, I just got to tell you, he's so impressive. He's a newly elected delegate to the State Assembly in Maryland, our dear, dear neighbor. His name is Gabriel Acevedo, and we're just so happy to have him on the show. Gabriel, are you with us?
I am. Pleasure, and thanks for having me, Senator Brown.
Oh, absolutely. First, let me tell you that I looked at your website, and I was just so impressed that you were endorsed by people like Ike Leggett. Those of you that don't know Maryland politics or Montgomery County, Ike Leggett is a legend in our area. He was a mentor to our former mayor, Adrian Fenty. He's been a politician in Maryland for many, many years, and he's just an amazing man. You had his endorsement. You had Nancy Navarro, who's the council vice president. You had six unions endorse you. You were endorsed by NARAL. I was just so impressed by that. And this is your first term, is it not?
It is. It's my first time running, first time being elected, but not my first time being on the front lines of social change and getting involved on issue campaigns, on issues that I would argue not only impact Maryland, but our region.
Well, we're going to talk about one of those that we're deeply grateful for in a moment, but yes, you've been involved in a lot of social causes from what I've read. And you said something on your website which really touched me. You said that you are not fit to lead if you're not willing to serve. And we hope that that's the way, or I do anyway, personally hope that that's the way politicians feel. Because, I think that says a lot about your character and the type of person you are, because it seems to me that you've been willing to serve, and really that's what politics is really about, is it not? That you serve your community, and I find it a great honor, and it sounds like you do too. So, so what led you to this? You were a real estate person, I read, in Baltimore. So how do you go from there to politics?
Well, taking it a little bit further back than that, I've always been an activist. I was a student activist in college. I've always been engaged in issues outside of my college campus. My first paid job as an organizer was with the Question, Foreign Question 6 campaigns back in 2011 and 2012, where we were pushing to pass the DREAM Act, not just legislatively, but at the ballot box, as well as Question 6, which is marriage equality, where we were fighting to ensure that every Marylander is recognized equally before the law. And then following that, I did a couple of issue campaigns, continued to be involved. I worked with my uncle briefly in real estate development in Baltimore City, just leading that effort, but also leading our organization's effort to ensure that we're providing not just affordable housing for Baltimoreans, but also budding entrepreneurs and nonprofit leaders who wanted to start a nonprofit, providing a service to the people of Baltimore, or starting a business and scaling it. We wanted to ensure that we were not just providing affordable housing for those in need, but ensuring those who would like to do good, those change agents, also have the resources and the space that they need to bring an idea from its early stage into fruition as a startup or as a nonprofit. So I'm really proud of the work that I've done when I was in Baltimore City. Today, I love to say that I'm still charmed by Charm City. And in fact, my district, District 39, was actually a district in Baltimore City. Now it's a district in Montgomery County. So I like to say I have the advantage of not just representing the good people of District 39 out in Montgomery County, but also the good people of Baltimore City as well. So really, the work that I've done speaks to the individual that I am, I believe, and my core values as an issue organizer then and now as a union organizer today. My focus has and continues to be one where we're building a just economy and a just society that takes care of those most vulnerable amongst us, from Black women to LGBTQ folks to working poor people to people with disabilities, people living with HIV/AIDS. And so these are the individuals that we need to be ensuring that we're centering. As I said when I was running, it is our responsibility as elected officials to ensure that we are taking care of those who are at the dawn of life. That is our youth, those who are at the twilight of life, our seniors, and those who exist in the shadows of life. And that is LGBTQ folks, Black women, poor working class people, people with disabilities, those folks who exist on the shadows of life, and whose issues and whose experiences we often discount. That is my life mission, and I'm truly grateful to the people of District 39 for entrusting me with their vote to not only represent them, but work to make that society that I just speak of, that just society that we as a country often speak about, but elude so many. And so I'm really grateful, and I would say we're already hitting the ground running in the 2019 legislative session and excited about the work and the issues that we're championing.
Well, that's, I agree with you 100% with what your mission is. And I think you're right about hitting the ground running with the legislative session. Let me ask you, you know, one of the things that we're very proud of in Washington, D.C. is that we do have marriage equality. Do you have marriage equality in Maryland at this point? I don't know.
We do. We do. Good. In fact, Maryland was the first state to approve marriage equality at the ballot box. It was passed in 2012 by the General Assembly. And there were those who were in opposition to marriage equality who managed to collect enough signatures to put the issue to a referendum. And so we were not just organizers in terms of the issue, but then we had to become issue campaign organizers, where we, in essence, formulated and implemented the strategy that we had developed years ago on how to, one, inform more Marylanders about what it is that we're fighting for, ensuring that everyone is equal before the law, and two, to ensure that we're making it clear that we will not have a separate but equal system where we have some parts of the law that pertain to cisgender heterosexual people and another part of the law dealing with LGBTQ folks. So I was proud of the work that we've done there. As I mentioned earlier, Maryland is the first and only state that I know of to have approved marriage equality at the ballot box in 2012.
Well, it's great that that happened. And you know, the fact that they pushed it to the ballot box and that the voters stood up and supported it, I think is it really says a lot about the character of Marylanders. You
right.
know, in Washington.
But also the work of the advocates, the work of the organizers. You know, I was proud to have been a part of that fight, but I recognize that it was a fight that I and others were not fighting alone. And there were, in fact, so many other people that made up our coalition, from community groups to faith leaders to labor leaders to community leaders. It really took a lot. We were able to not just organize people. We're not able to just fundraise, but we were able to combat the narrative of what those who oppose this measure was trying to do, to paint not just the issue, but us pushing this very important issue as something that we were not. So I think it speaks more than just about Marylanders, but it speaks to the grit of the advocates and the organizers and the people who showed up and cared, and those that volunteered the day that we had to vote on the issue. I remember being in the cold at 4:45 in the morning, setting up because polls were opening early, and we wanted to ensure that we had a presence at the polls and talking to people about why this issue is important and why we need to ensure that we're recognizing LGBTQ couples before the law the same as we would any other couple. So really proud of the work, and I'd be remiss if I said that I and a few others were solely responsible for this heavy lift. It took a really caring community. It took passionate advocates, and it took dedicated organizers. And I'm really proud that that Maryland was able to show the rest of the nation that, but also on the DREAM Act, which is huge. Maryland led the way on the DREAM Act. And really what was the impetus for that was the DREAM Act failed at the federal level. Congress failed to act on the DREAM Act. And what Maryland showed the rest of the nation is that, one, we value undocumented immigrants. We value immigrants and their contributions that they not only make to our economy, but to the social and political fabric that is America. And so it was a very strong statement. And as an immigrant, as someone who share the aspirations of other immigrants and immigrant families that come to this country, work hard, play by the rules, and try to make a better life for themselves and their children, we owe it to them to reject the kind of demonization that we're seeing from this White House and from members of the administration, and ensure that we're welcoming all people. Right. And we're living up to the ideals, the American ideals and values that says, give us your weary and your tired and your masses, those, you know, yearning for opportunity, for change, for inclusion. That is the ideals that we must live up to and the state and the country that we must be committed to building.
Well, you know, again, this is one of the things I like about you, is that I feel that you're a politician that was built from the ground up, you know, that given your background. Now, you went to Montgomery College in Rockville, I assume. It's where I went to, where I started college. We both have Associate of Arts. I'm sorry?
No, I said it's very nice. I went to the Germantown campus.
Oh, you did, Germantown.
In my district.
Yes. Well, this will show you how old I am, Gabriel. There wasn't a Germantown campus when I went there. They were just building the Germantown campus when I was at Montgomery College. But, you know, it's a community college. And from there, you went to the University of Maryland, Baltimore. I went to the University of Maryland, College Park. I grew up not far from your district in Wheaton. You know, I come from a first-generation immigrant family. Both of my parents died when I was 15 years old, unfortunately. And community college gave me a way to start life, or start an academic career, which ended with me getting a master's degree. But I dropped out of high school when my parents died. And you know, like I say, I come from a first generation immigrant family, and people have said to me many times, why did you get back into school? What was it that motivated you to get back into school? And, you know, I say to them, that's what America was to my family. Education was the single most important issue. So if I had gone to my grandmother and said, I just won the Powerball lottery and I got $100 million, the first thing she would have said to me is, good, now you can afford to go back to school and get a college education. So when you talk about the Dream Act, I think it's so important. These dreamers are the people that built America. America is, in fact, a dream. When it was founded on principles that had never been tried before. And nothing bothers me more than to see the attacks that have come on these people who, as you point out, are loyal American citizens. They've gone about things the right way. They're here to make America a better place for all of us. And they really are. This is really what the American dream is about, right? It's about a better life for all of us. And you seem to exemplify
absolutely.
That.
And I must say, you know, based on your life and what you're telling me, it sounds like you're an alum of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, because we know True Grit there. In fact, that's our mascot, right? True Grit, the retriever. And it sounds like that's exactly the kind of grit that you've shown over the years in order to get where you are. You know, we have a saying at UMBC, when they tell you that you can, tell them UMBC, right? And if anything, it sounds like you're an alum of UMBC. But I'm really really glad to see you in this position, Senator. I think you certainly add quite a bit to the conversation, especially around D.C. statehood. And I was proud to have you on our panel testifying in support of the resolution that I introduced supporting D.C. statehood. And I think it's time that we get there.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, of course, because this show is partially dedicated to that whole concept. And before we go any further, since we're talking about the University of Maryland, let me tell you that my heart goes out to the Maryland Terrapins, who made it to the NCAA basketball tournament, won their first game, and unfortunately fell in a very tough game to LSU yesterday. They lost by 2 points, but we're so proud of their success and a great season, and we know they'll do even better next year. But let's move on and talk, because I just think this is such an exceptional thing you've done, Delegate Acevedo, to introduce this resolution to support D.C. statehood. And this is really what D.C. statehood needs, because if we could bestow statehood upon ourselves, we would have done it already. We really need people. we really need people in the states to reach out. And one of our problems in doing that is that, you know, as we say in politics, most people don't have a dog in this fight. They don't, you know, if we become a state, it really doesn't help the people of California or Nevada or New Jersey. It really helps the people of Washington, D.C. It is the right thing to do. It is a principle that America was built on. But we're very often told by people in your position, we're very often told, yes, we agree with you, but, you know, our job is to take care of the people of our state. So what is it that motivated you to do this? I mean, I just think it's exceptional.
Yeah, well, for one, I think democracy is an aspiration. It is something that we are still working on. And I think what's clear from the amount of gerrymandering, the amount of disenfranchising of voters that we see in various parts of this country, I think it's important for us as Americans, regardless of what jurisdiction or state you live in, to ensure that everyone, every American citizen has access to the ballot box and are able to participate in their democracy, right? That is how you approve of the elected officials, the policies, the discussion that we are having in these halls of power. And I think it's no different for the District of Columbia. In fact, I find it ridiculous that despite having a population larger than states that have representation in the Congress, despite the fact that district residents pay federal taxes, millions of dollars in federal taxes every single year, despite the fact that we wage wars with the tax dollars of Washingtonians, with the men and women from this great city, yet this very same city does not have representation in the Congress that levies those taxes, declares those wars, to me is ridiculous. And we need to ensure that we are providing every American, regardless of where they live, with access to the ballot box, representation in the Congress, and full voting rights and budgetary autonomy. And I think the District of Columbia, you know, a lot of props and respect to the freedom fighters who have come before and have been pushing this issue for years, like Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and others, and so many mayors. It is now incumbent upon us as neighbors, neighboring jurisdictions, to ensure that the District of Columbia is not the only loudest voice for D.C. statehood. It is in the best interest of every single state in the United States when every American has a right and a say in their democracy. And so for me, it was an easy question. It was a one of solidarity. It was one recognizing the fact that D.C. deserves not just representation in the Congress, but autonomy to make decisions that impact their city and their residents. And what we wanted to accomplish with this resolution that we introduced in the General Assembly is to show that Maryland is adding its voice to the already growing number of states and community leaders that are calling for DC statehood. And so this resolution was really crafted from Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton's bill, H.R. 51, which seeks to make D.C. the 51st state in the union. Our resolution was based on that piece of legislation. And in essence, what it says is that the state of Maryland that played such a role in the formation of the district is in support of the District of Columbia, not just becoming the 51st state, but ensuring that the people of the District of Columbia have representation in the Congress. They have budgetary autonomy. they have a local autonomy and respect the way other localities do. And so this piece of resolution that I'm proud to say got over 30 co-sponsors in the House, I hope not only shifts the conversation about what solidarity looks like, but I also hope that it moves the conversation on why we desperately need to fight the district residents and their right to be an independent state with representation and autonomy. And so that's what we were trying to accomplish with this resolution. And I'm glad to see and to hear that so many folks, both in Maryland and the District of Columbia, are supportive of this. I'm proud to say that the majority of the congressional delegation, the Maryland congressional delegation, supports DC statehood, save for one congressman who I think we can all guess, who is in opposition to DC statehood.
I assume that's Mr. Barr from Ocean City. I assume it's Mr. Barr from Ocean City, but not just
Barr, but also Representative Andy Harris as well.
Oh, Andy Harris,
part of the Maryland congressional delegation. I'm proud to say that the majority of the congressional delegation supports this, and it's time that we put it on the agenda. You know, it is way past time for DC to become the 51st state, and I'm hoping we can have a robust discussion about that and how we ensure that every American has a voice in their government.
Well, first of all, I misspoke. This happens to you when you get old, Delegate Acevedo, so don't let it happen to you. Bob Barr was actually from Georgia, and he was a protagonist, but it's Andy Harris who is just like him, unfortunately, for the people of the District of Columbia, and he's from Ocean City. As you may know, some activists from Washington, D.C., including people from my office, went to campaign in the primary for his opponent because he's been such a problem. Thanks for correcting me on that. And you're right. First of all, let me tell you, I feel a kindred spirit like you do to Baltimore. It was one of my first jobs in life. I lied about my age and I became a Teamster and I was a delivery driver in Baltimore. It is a really great city with a lot of great people, but it also has a lot of problems. And given your attitude about or your approach to affordable housing, we certainly could use some of your input in the District of Columbia on that, because we have such an affordable housing problem here. But where do we stand on the resolution? Has it been approved? I know you have 30 co-sponsors, and that's great. We've got both United States senators from Maryland on our bill, and we had the former senator from Maryland, Barbara McCluskey, on our bill when it was up. Maryland has always been strong supporters of statehood. People that know the history know that all of the District of Columbia comes from a piece of Maryland. It was originally donated land from Maryland and Virginia, but we gave the Virginia piece back in the 1800s when there were slave owners in Virginia that were afraid that the district was going to abolish slavery, which we're all proud to say here in the District of Columbia, we were the first jurisdiction to abolish slavery. But all the property that now is the District of Columbia was once a piece of Maryland. But where do we stand on the resolution? Has it been approved by the legislature?
Well, I think that speaks to, and just to go back to your earlier point, I think that speaks to the importance of the resolution, that Maryland sends a clear message, and you're absolutely right, from Senator Mikulski to our entire congressional delegation, Maryland has been steadfast in their support. Our congressional delegation has been steadfast in their support for D.C. statehood. And I think that kind of a leadership now needs to be seen from our state capital in Annapolis. And that's why I introduced it, and we're advocating for the resolution to gain traction. As you know, we had the hearing for the resolution some weeks ago before the Rules and Executive Nominations Committee. I would say that the resolution was seen, it was received favorably. I think there are some discussions that are being had right now, and there are some folks from the Eastern Shore, some folks from Western Maryland, who are still on the fence about the issue. I think now is the time for us to be having those kind of a conversations. And hopefully with the introduction of this resolution, we can have those conversations so that in the event that the resolution does not pass this session when we adjourn sine die, we can bring the issue up again next year and hopefully get a little more traction on the issue than we did this past session. So there was a hearing for it. My understanding is that the committee has not voted on whether to bring the resolution to the floor. So that's pretty much where we are right now. But I do think, based on the conversations that I've had with committee leaderships and folks in the House, that folks are generally favorable towards the idea of showing solidarity with the District of Columbia, that we support statehood. I think folks are just holding out to see what kind of a conversation comes out from this and whether we have the necessary votes in order to pass this resolution. But I'm really optimistic and confident about this resolution. I think if not this session, certainly next session, we will see greater movement on it. And the fact that the resolution received 30-plus co-sponsors speaks to not just the kind of support that it has in the House, but also I see that as a reflection of general support for DC statehood across the state of Maryland. The folks who have sponsored, co-sponsored this resolution come from the Eastern Shore to Prince George's County, to Baltimore City, to Baltimore County, to Montgomery County, to Howard County. And so that's from all parts of our state. And I not only see that as, you know, just the kind of support that it has on the House floor, but the general support that it has in Maryland. So I'm really optimistic, and I think we can get it done. And it'll be a really powerful thing. As you rightly pointed out, D.C. is what Maryland once was. And so I think if there is any state that needs to be the most vocal advocates for districts, D.C. statehood, is the state of Maryland. And that's something that I'm committed to championing and having those uncomfortable conversations, even with my colleagues who are still on the fence and still iffy about whether D.C. should become the 51st state and whether Maryland should be supporting that effort.
Well, first of all, let me say that it couldn't be in better hands as far as I'm concerned. I think that you're just such a passionate advocate, and, you know, we so much appreciate your help. And what you say is absolutely true. This is why we fight to get co-sponsors. We've got 201 co-sponsors on H.R. 51, which you mentioned earlier. And also, we have a record number of 31 co-sponsors in the Senate. Now, we on companion legislation. Now, we understand that for us to become a state, we've got to pass in both houses and get it signed by the president. And that's not likely to happen, you know, this time. We're hopeful to get it passed in the House of Representatives. We know that it's dubious to get it past the Senate, and even a bigger long shot to get the president of the United States to sign it at this time. But we understand that we're building momentum. And if not this time, next time, and if not next time, the time after that. If there's an issue that is certainly a marathon and not a sprint, it's certainly this issue. So thanks again for all your help. But I want to move on to another piece of legislation that you've introduced that I find just so intriguing. When I was 17 years old, I was a hippie. I was an activist. I came into Washington, D.C. one night, and some of my friends had been arrested. I went to a police station, and I got beat up for no reason at all, other than the fact that I had long hair, and the cops didn't seem to like me at the time. And we brought charges against the police department. It didn't go forward. The district attorney refused to take the case after a preliminary hearing. But you have introduced a law in Maryland called Anton's Law. Can you tell us about that? Because it deals directly with this sort of thing. And I think, again, I admire you for your courage to bring this forth. And also, I think it's very, very important. So can you tell us, what does Anton's Law really say, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to, and I'm going to touch on Anton's Law, why we introduced it, the intent of the bill, where we are right now. But I think it's also important for us to have a broader conversation about police violence, about state-sanctioned violence, about police brutality, about the lack of transparency from police departments, not just across our state, but across this country. I think it's time that we look at how we can make police departments, which are among the most unaccountable public institutions, more transparent and more accountable to the broader communities that they serve. And so I've always been engaged in that fight. It's been a longstanding fight from the women's rights movement. We saw how police brutality played a role in hindering women seeking the right to vote. Police violence was an issue during the civil rights movement. We know that there were many instances of police brutality where individuals in the movement were either killed or hurt. And the lack of transparency around it and the lack of accountability created this gap between law enforcement and communities, but specifically communities of color. And we see that play out again during the Stonewall riots, or the catalyst for the LGBTQ movement in the United States came about as a result of police violence. We see the modern-day Black Lives Matter movement, of which I'm proud to be a part of and a proud Black Lives Matter activist. We see the movement for Black Lives, but all of these movements that I speak of dealt with the issue of police violence and state-sanctioned violence. And as Coretta Scott King so rightly put it, struggle is something that every generation has to be engaged in, because the moment we make progress, the moment we have gotten rights, they are organizing and strategizing on how to take that away from us. And I think it's no different for police violence. You remember Rodney King. You remember recently here in Maryland, Freddie Gray to Robert yep. White in Montgomery County, where I live. It's a longstanding issue that, one, there has been an absence of political will to deal with. Two, there have been an absence of courage to stand up to the bad actors and the people who are responsible for continuing the kind of improper practices that we see in police departments, like the chiefs and the sheriff's association and the FOP. And I think it's important for every elected official now, especially those who are running for re-election, those who are seeking elected office for the first time, it is important and it has to be on the agenda of everyone to ensure that we're bringing about greater transparency and accountability. And we can have discussion about what accountability looks like from our police departments to ensure that we are not just creating a greater rift, but we are ending a very shocking statistic that every 28 hours, a black man, woman, or child is extrajudicially executed by law enforcement in the United States. The many cases that we have heard of, from Freddie Gray to Michael Brown to Antoine Rose recently in Pittsburgh to Laquan McDonald in Chicago to Stephon Clark in Sacramento, those cases that we know about, we must not only be on the forefront or on the front lines fighting for change, but we must also ask the burning and uncomfortable question, well, what about the cases that we don't know about, right? Because what we know is that the Chicago Police Department was complicit in attempting to hide the footage of the assassination of Laquan McDonald. So we know that our police departments are not good at holding their own, holding themselves accountable. And so last year, September, a young man, Anton Black, who was 19, was killed while in police custody. And so many things went wrong with this situation and were completely avoidable. But it ended in the untimely death of a young man who had such a promising future. And what followed that was just as reprehensible, that the family can be requesting information as to whether an investigation was conducted, the status of that investigation, the outcome of that investigation, as well as the officer involved, Officer Webster's prior record, which we ended up finding out, the community ended up finding out, because the police department was not giving any information at all. But what we ended up finding out was that Officer Webster was previously employed in Delaware. And this was right. Someone who had a deplorable record with the police department there. In fact, a viral video of him showed him kicking an unarmed black man while he was down. That was the cause for his termination. And he drove 35 minutes from Delaware across state lines into Maryland, and he was hired by the Greensboro Police Department. So this is the man who is responsible for the untimely death of Anton Black. And so when the family was requesting information and asking the mayor and the police chief to put the officer on administrative leave, they disregarded that. They requested information related to an investigation and the status of that. They did not receive that. They were asking questions about the cause of death. They were not receiving any information at all. And so,
well, and isn't that often the case? Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was saying, and isn't that often the case? He's a problem in our department, so we just get rid of him. But exactly. But we don't get rid of the problem. We just allow it to exist somewhere else. I mean, that's just horrible.
Correct.
But go ahead. Correct. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And so the family was requesting information, and finally the issue got all the way to the governor, who requested that information be released. And not shortly after, that information was not only released, but additional information and footage was also released as well. And so the family had to go through not just the pain of their son dying, but the pain of not knowing whether Anton Black would receive any justice at all. The fact that you live in a community and you're requesting answers from a police department that is sworn to protect and to serve the very people that live there, and could not get any information at all. And so what our bill, House Bill 1011, and it's been cross-filed with Senator Jill Carter from Baltimore City, Senate Bill 1037, named after Anton Black, it's called Anton's Law. What the bill calls for is the Police Trainings and Standards Commission to set up and implement a process by which, if a complainant were to request information as to an investigation, the status or outcome of that investigation, that would be provided, or the findings of fact, and any prior record of the officer involved, if the complainant were to request that, that they receive that as well. And we know that's important because Officer Webster, who was involved in the death of Anton Black, was able to drive 35 minutes across state line and be hired by another police department in this state after having such a deplorable record in Delaware. The fact that no one, and I find it hard to believe that law enforcement is has access to so much information, yet no one could have seen and flagged this officer's deplorable record and deny him employment in a police department that is so small that everyone in the Greensboro community knows the police chief and the officers. And I say that to say so that you and your listeners could understand just how much the community was rocked by this death, because not only was someone that they saw grow up, Anton Black, right before their eyes being be killed, but the police department is so small that when they refused to put the officer on administrative leave, this is the same officer that community members were seeing right back in the community again. What does that say about the trust that we're trying to build with the community? What does that say about the family that was going through so much pain and is still going through so much pain, right? So there are so many things that was wrong with this situation, but chief among them was the lack of transparency and information sharing, despite the fact that the family and the community had requested it. They were unrelenting in their demands and did not receive anything. Anything until the governor had demanded that that information be released. And no one, especially when you have experienced a situation like that, should have to pray that their child or family member's death would get the attention of an elected official in order to get some semblance of justice. And that should never be. And so Anton's law, in essence, asks for that kind of a transparency and information sharing. And if passed, would require that. And so we recently had a hearing for the bill on February 26th before the House Judiciary Committee. The Senate Bill 1037, which was cross-filed, will be heard this Tuesday, March 26, in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. And we are just pushing to not only honor this young man, but to get justice for him, right? We owe it to Anton. We owe it to his family. We owe it to the community that raised him to ensure that we're doing better. We're not providing we're not just providing closure for the family and the community, but we're doing better by the community by making our police departments more accountable to the communities that they serve. And so that's why we introduced it. That's where it is. This Tuesday, we're going to have a press conference with members of the Legislative Black Caucus, the NAACP, ACLU of Maryland, Out for Justice, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, all these community organizations and leaders who are supportive of our bill, standing with the Black family and demanding. And I want to point out, Senator, because I think this is key, that this has to be one of a myriad of actions that we need to take to deal with the issue of police violence. This law, this bill, Anton's law, seeks transparency and information sharing. But there's so much work that we need to do around hiring practices to ensure that terrible individuals like Officer Webster is not being hired by the police department. In addition to that, I will say that we need to go further to ensure that white nationalists, those who are affiliated with white nationalist groups, aren't being employed by our police departments, as was recently discovered in Virginia and in other parts of the country. That is the work that we need to do, and that is still outstanding. We need to ensure that we're setting up trial boards. We need to ensure that those hearings are public. We need to ensure that there are special prosecutors to handle cases of police-involved death and use of force. And I'm not talking about the current arrangements that we have right now where jurisdictions would switch cases basically whenever there's an officer involved death. What we need is a special prosecutor within the Attorney General's office dedicated to investigating and prosecuting bad actors, rogue officers, and corrupt cops. And so I don't want us to lose sight of the bigger issue. Yes, we are going to be pushing and fighting to pass Anton's law, and we will get it done. But this is a part of a more broader conversation around transparency, accountability, and police violence that we must have and that we must act on.
Well, again, I agree with you. And I want to point out to our listeners, again, how courageous I think your stand is, because the groups that you mentioned, the FOP, the Sheriff's Association, these are strong political groups. And these are people that push back on every issue that involves the police department. And we all know of the cases, you outlined several of them, where the first line of defense for the police department is keep our mouths shut, close our ranks, make sure that, you know, we've all got each other's back. So transparency is so important, but it's also very, very brave of you, Delia Severo, to stand up as a freshman legislator and take a stand like this. Believe it or not, we're almost out of time here. We just have a few minutes left. And I want to say that I just admire so much your passion for what you're doing and your commitment to these causes, not only for the District of Columbia, we all appreciate your support, but also for the other issues that you're involved in. Let me tell you that if I was still in Montgomery County, you would certainly have my vote. You had me. You had me when I looked at your election video. You had me from the moment that your nephew said, "Don't forget to vote for my Uncle Gabe." That would have been enough for me right there. But yeah. You know, you're an amazing legislator, I think, and it gives me so much hope for the future. Old guy that I am, that I can't even remember that Bob Barr's from Georgia and not from Maryland. Old guy that I am, it gives me such hope for the future that we have young legislators like you out there working to make America a better place. And before we leave, I want to give you an opportunity to say anything you want to say that you didn't get a chance to say. Is there anything that you want to do, or is there a website that you would like to give our listeners that they can refer to help you in lobbying for the things that you're trying to get passed?
Yeah, I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to be on the show and to have a discussion with you about issues of mutual concern to both Maryland and the district, but also just the issues that I'm working on. I will add an issue that I'm working on that I'm deeply passionate about is universal basic income. I introduced a bill, House Bill 1089, that was assigned to the House Ways and Means Committee that we had a hearing for recently that would lay the groundwork for universal basic income in the state of Maryland. And I hope that our neighbors in D.C. and in Virginia would also follow suit, because I think it's one of those transformative policies that can and will put a dent in extreme poverty. And for the benefit of your listeners, universal basic income is, in essence, where every month we would pay a resident a monetary allotment, no questions asked, to every individual in our state. That's the hope. That's the hope that we would eventually get there. And so my bill, House Bill 1089, what it does is it hopes to accomplish is to establish the Maryland People's Fund, which in essence is a social wealth fund. And what we're calling for is 25% from the tax on the revenue of the sale of medical cannabis to be placed in this non-lapsing fund to be overseen and managed by our state treasurer, who currently invests state dollars into various portfolios. And so what my bill seeks to accomplish is this fund to be established, to be overseen by our state treasurer, and she, our treasurer, would invest those funds in two portfolios and the principal from which we would be able to pay out a universal basic income. This is an issue that has been championed by a number of leaders in previous years. It is an issue that has been accepted by both Republicans and Democrats, folks on the left and the right alike. In fact, President Nixon introduced the conversation in the Congress twice in the 1970s, and the Republicans...
Negative income tax. I remember negative income tax, and he led the fight with Daniel Patrick Moynihan,
exactly.
who was a Democrat. So you'll have to come back. We're out of time. You'll have to come back to talk about this because I think it's important. Thank you for all the hard work you're doing. Thank you for caring about the people of the District of Columbia. You're good neighbors, and you have a new friend in politics in D.C., and if there's anything I can ever do for you, Delegate Acevedo, you need only ask. Thanks for being on our show. We hope you'll come back soon, and thank you to our listeners for listening to us, and we're going to leave you tonight. We usually leave you with a song, and this goes out to my fellow University of Maryland alumni, Gabriel Acevedo, and the Maryland Terrapins. Here's the Maryland fight song. We'll see you next week. Thanks again, Delegate. We appreciate
it. Thanks for having me, Senator.
Give the people their right to vote.